Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Pacific Gas and Electric Company's decision to cut power to hundreds of thousands of customers, both last month and now again this week, has thrown the Bay Area into disarray. The utility, which filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy back in January, has implemented the rolling blackouts in the face of dry, windy weather, the same conditions that existed when PG&E equipment sparked fires in the past. And almost 800,000 customer accounts have lost power, some for several days. And when I say customer accounts, that actually translates to over 2 million individual residents. Yet despite these measures, fires have still raged, people evacuated, and in some cases lost homes. Are blackouts the new normal now in the Bay Area? If so, what's being done to assist the most vulnerable? What do these events mean for the future of PG&E? And what can PG&E, our cities, the state, and residents of the Bay Area do to keep the lights on? Joining me here in the studio to discuss these issues and more is Nick Chassett, Chief Executive Officer of East Bay Community Energy and former Chief of Staff to the President of the California Public Utilities Commission and Special Energy Advisor to former Governor Jerry Brown. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you very much, Ethan.
And joining us by phone is Martha Guzman Aceves, Commissioner at the California Public Utilities Commission, where she focuses on issues related to fuel switching, broadband access, water affordability, access to distributed solar, and various other energy and telecommunications issues. Welcome, Martha.
Thank you. Good evening.
And we're also joined on the phone by Michael Wara, lawyer and senior research scholar and director of the Climate and Energy Policy Program at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me on, Ethan.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. We'll open the phone lines up in just about 20 minutes, but we want to hear from you and the questions you have for the panelists. You can reach us at that point by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-7988255. You can write that down now for 20 minutes from now. But you can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or on our Facebook page, and we're at City Visions KALW on Twitter. Well, Michael, let me start with you. Can you give listeners an overview of the power generation and distribution system that's at issue here? What exactly is being shut down and why?
Sure. Well, PG&E has a system that relies primarily, although not exclusively, on overhead lines. That is, electricity lines that are strung between poles that we see above our heads in many places in Northern California. The challenge is that over the last several years, we've seen fires sparked by those lines. In 2017, primarily because trees blew into the lower voltage distribution lines, which are kind of like the last mile of service. And in 2018, and possibly this year, because components of the higher voltage line, the larger towers that kind of are the backbone of the system, failed in ways that started fires.
And so transmission lines, by and large, are they still remaining with energy? Because I know that there, the Kincaid fire potentially could have been sparked by a transmission line that had an outage. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the transmission lines that PG&E owns and operates, are operated by the independent system operator, are of varying age, and so the fire that caused the appears to cause the campfire was sparked by a very old piece of the system, really part of the original PG&E system. And so after the campfire this year in power shutoff, PG&E's been turning off lines that are like that, of that vintage, the kind of lower voltage older lines. The Kincaid fire may have been sparked, appears to have ignited very near to a transmission tower which is much newer and which suffered a fault at the time of the fire. Now, by new in this context, we don't mean last year or even last decade, but I believe the tower was 43 years old, but had been inspected multiple times over the last couple of years and appeared to be in good shape.
So definitely aging infrastructure is part of this. And Nick Chassett, let me bring you into this discussion. So I think people are generally familiar with PG&E and their service territory. Certainly it encompasses, you know, most of the Bay Area here. But can you explain about East Bay Community Energy's model here. How does East Bay Community Energy fit into this picture?
Yeah, so East Bay Community Energy is a community choice aggregator. We are a local public agency. In our case, we serve Alameda County, so 12 communities in Alameda County. And what we do is we buy electricity on behalf of our customers, the vast majority of residents and businesses in Alameda County, and we distribute it to our customers over the PG&E infrastructure. In our case, we deliver clean, low-cost energy that customers have an option to choose.
And you're still using the PG&E system, so even though you're aggregating these different customers to purchase energy, you're still essentially held hostage by what PG&E decides to do with their lines. Is that right?
Correct. So all of our customers are also PG&E customers. They are the distribution, what we call the wires customer, and then we are the generation or electricity customer.
And let's just say a fire were to start in the territory in Alameda County where you serve. Would East Bay Community Energy be liable the same way PG&E is?
We don't have infrastructure that we own, so the liability is associated with the infrastructure they may cause the fire. And so in that case, we don't have that sort of strict liability that PG&E has as it pertains to their infrastructure.
And Martha Guzman-Aceves, you're one of the chief energy regulators in the state. Can you just describe how we got to this point where we now have to have these blackouts in PG&E service territory?
Yes. Well, I think maybe Michael mentioned pretty correctly some of the examples of our recent history started way before this recent series of unfortunate utility-caused fires. But back in 2007 in San Diego Gas and Electric's territory, San Diego had about four fires that were particularly catastrophic, and after the aftermath of those fires, they began trying to approach the situation more holistically, and the exercising of shutoffs was one component of many components, and I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about much of the investment that's taken place in San Diego to avoid the frequency and the scope of the shutoffs. But still today, San Diego does do shutoffs, as does Southern California Edison. But essentially, the beginning of the use of shutoffs as a preventative measure for starting catastrophic fires began out of San Diego about a decade ago, and really isn't until post-campfire that PG&E decided to start to activate it as a tool, unfortunately, and I'm sure we're going to talk about how poorly they've done that. But that the history is really as a measure among many, and the measure of last resort, which is another important element to try to prevent wildfires.
Well, Martha, I'm glad you brought up San Diego Gas and Electric and how they've been working on this issue essentially since 2007, and everything that I've read indicates that they got a head start over PG&E and have done a much better job. Even though they have blackouts, they've been able to sort of cordon off their grid so that the blackouts are much more targeted to where the actual risk is. They've done a better job in terms of hardening their grid and vegetation management, all that kind of stuff. And I know it's a different climate and vegetative environment down there, but why did San Diego do a good job, and yet we've been okay with sort of letting PG&E now just suddenly seem to figure out that they need to take this seriously?
Well, I think they've done a good job as they've gotten better through the years. And by the way, they still have certainly customers on their end that have a constant relationship with SDG&E to try to improve some of the mitigation measures that they could offer there as well, because they're dealing with a lot of the same issues, wells not being able to be operated, no water, vulnerable communities. But like you said, they have had more time to try to deal with this, to work with their local governments, to work with their local providers, so they are much better prepared. And of course, they're largely just one county. They have a little bit of Orange, but San Diego County, the scale of it is much smaller.
Well, Martha, I know that you've you've been on the Public Utilities Commission for you know just a few years, and this issue predates your tenure on there. But when you look back, you know, where were the failures here? Was this PG&E management failures? Was this a failure of regulators to ensure that PG&E was taking the steps that it needed to take when it could have been acting more aggressively even a decade ago on this? Where do you think the sort of blame falls in terms of what's happened to date here?
Well, I think our collective failure is that we didn't really appreciate the effects that the climate would have on the lack of investment. And when you had, when we got behind on the investment, when PG&E got behind on the investment, and the repercussions of that grew exponentially, it was something that was unforecasted, I think, to both the PUC and PG&E, and even SCE, prior to probably just 4 years ago.
And Michael Warr, when you look back over the last decade or so, what do you think happened to get us to this point? I mean, Martha mentioned climate change is maybe taking people somewhat by surprise, although we have had models predicting these types of severe dry periods and dry vegetation. But how do you ascribe blame here?
Well, I think I would say that I absolutely agree with what Commissioner Gustafsson just said, that it's a collective failure, that there were many people, especially after the San Bruno accident, looking at the risks that the utility system poses to its customers, and we really didn't see this coming. And that should be a warning sign, I think, to many who think we fully understand all of the impacts of climate change. What was so complex to understand here was how the changing weather and climate would interact with investment decisions and operational decisions that have worked well over the last century in terms of keeping rates affordable and the lights on for most customers. We didn't see that coming. Now, is there room to cast blame? Or maybe so, but I would encourage everyone to realize that even talking to San Diego and their wildfire safety team, they will tell you that the conditions that they're experiencing now are really unprecedented, and they're having to use power shutoff as a tool much more than they were in the early parts of their program, because the conditions have gotten so much more extreme as we've seen these very extended dry falls. And so I think everyone is playing catch-up, not just PG&E. The problem also, though, is that so many more people live in dangerous parts of the PG&E service territory. And the territory, in contrast to San Diego's, has much less undergrounding of utility wires, because the housing in the territory, the communities were built at a time when undergrounding was uncommon. Whereas much of San Diego County, especially the eastern part of the county where the risk is, with the population growth there occurred recently. And so new development had utilities undergrounded when the streets were laid out. And so it's just a different problem. But I think the main thing we all need to be thinking about is how to manage this problem going forward in a way that creates access and equity, and that's a huge challenge.
And Nick, I wanted to bring you in on this question of how we got to this point. I think Michael and Martha have both cited important factors here: climate change and the utility business model perhaps converging here to create the situation that we're now in. What do you see? I mean, you've been in the energy space for a long time. You were at the Public Utilities Commission working with former President Michael Picker. What's your perspective on how we got here?
I think Martha and Michael sort of touched on the points. There was not a collective sense even 5-6 years ago that these risk factors would be so severe so fast. And so while certainly there were considerations of the kinds of investments that San Diego had been making maybe a decade sooner than the other two, this was not something that was in the model, so it wasn't at the top of mind. I will say also there had been much emphasis in the case of PG&E on San Bruno and on the natural gas system. So I think organizationally, at least my perspective was, the PUC was very much focused on how to get the gas system into a place that it could be operated in a safe, reliable fashion.
Yeah, I do. For those who don't remember the San Bruno explosion, the natural gas explosion on faulty PG&E gas line, so a whole other area of danger when it comes to our utility service. Well, let's talk about the impact of these blackouts. And, Nick, you're working closely with folks in Alameda County. I gather your county is not quite as affected. A lot of your area seems to be, at least the urban area, has not been part of the public safety power shutoffs. But what have you been seeing in terms of impacts to customers from these blackouts?
So we've had over 70,000 customers in predominantly Oakland and Berkeley, but other communities as well, who have had extended shutoffs multiple days.
And those are customer accounts, right?
These are customer accounts. So these are largely residential customers, so households where, you know, you likely have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people. So, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are losing power and, you know, all the impacts associated, economic impacts. It might be spoiled food. You know, we're certainly hearing some instances of, you know, people who have medical needs who are feeling very much at risk. Thankfully, we have yet to have any reports of any fatalities associated with this. So that's been positive. I think, you know, our first responders and our local government emergency management services have done a very good job of outreach to our communities and trying to understand the impacts. One of the challenges we do have is access to information. So one of the, particularly during the first power shutoff, there were a lot of challenges we were hearing from our local governments about not knowing where the shutoffs were occurring, getting conflicting reports about where the shutoffs were occurring. And, you know, that's in a community, Alameda County, that is much less impacted. You think about my colleagues who run CCAs in Sonoma County or Marin County, and that's just here in the Bay Area, you hear stories of 5, 6 day shutoffs, businesses losing tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of food or merchandise, and you really start to think about really significant impacts. And the biggest challenge is there's just not, in many people's perspective, there's not a clear sense of what to do. And I think that's something we at East Bay Community Energy have been focused on, is trying to think through what are solutions we can deliver to our customers that aren't a diesel generator, that is going to be exacerbating the climate challenge that we, and frankly, exacerbating our near-term environmental impacts. You hear stories of generators themselves causing fires. So we have this dual challenge, and that's something we're really focused on at East Bay Community Energy.
You know, I want to talk about the equity impacts from the blackouts, and it looked to me like from the maps, like it's mostly the sort of higher income tracts that are experiencing the blackouts. Is that accurate? I mean, how much is this affecting low income people versus, you know, some of the higher income folks who live up in the hills?
I think in Alameda County, you're right that it's predominantly been in the Oakland and Berkeley Hills where we've seen the impacts, but certainly that's not the case across the state. I think you see a lot of pretty significant impacts across Northern California, and you know the reality is the impacts do disproportionately affect those who are low income or sort of in medically fragile situations. And the example being, you know, there's a more of a likelihood if you think about food spoilage. If you know somebody's buying in bulk and they're out for 4, 5, 6 days, you're going to have more food spoilage. And so, you know, that will disproportionately impact a low-income individual or low-income family than it would a medium or higher-income family. And I think that's an experience that we've heard about across Northern California and certainly is one of our big challenges.
And Martha, to go to you, what do you worry about with these blackouts in terms of you know, the sort of the worst case scenario or the effects of these blackouts?
Oh well, unfortunately, there's as Nick was saying, some of these Northern California counties are already dealing with extremely high poverty rates. You know, Supervisor Simon from Lake County has come to participate in some of our proceedings, and he's shared some incredible impacts that have happened there. You know, he's talked about how not only in Lake County, they were particularly hard hit because in between shutoffs, they were not able to be turned back on. So many of his constituents were off of power for over a continuous week. And one of the things that he shared was particularly talking about food security and food spoilage, that the schools were out. And just the amount of anxiety, and particularly for not only for you know, working parents who need to go to work, who oftentimes commute into the Bay Area for better paying jobs. You know, we're coming back. The CRCs were already closed when they were back. Their kids had to either find some sort of emergency situation or home alone in the dark. And on top of that, many of the kids in his, he's from Clear Lake, in that area, in that school district, are on the free lunch program. So it's all these compounding things that are horrible. This morning I also talked to the mayor from Nevada City, Mayor Sinem, who shared the ripple effects that are happening in her community. And once again, the kind of fresh produce and restaurant sector, food and beverage sector is the hardest hit there. And she shared about a couple of restaurants that are closing. And of course, lower wage workers in those sectors and the ripple effects that are happening there.
Well, and at some point, you know, as these blackouts keep going for a week or so, like in Lake County, as you mentioned, or Mendocino, I mean, there's risks of the water treatment pumps not operating anymore. Is that right?
Yes. The supervisor did share that they were on the verge because the type of the degree of backup they had set up at the wastewater facility was not for that long of a continuous time. And unfortunately, they had not. This is not an area that PG&E had invested some of their generation, backup generation for. So they were very strapped, and that is a very huge public health and safety issue that's a concern, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one thing to lose electricity, but to lose drinking water is a whole other thing. Well, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. I'm Ethan Elkind, and tonight we're discussing blackouts and the future of electricity in the Bay Area. We're joined by guest Nick Chassett, CEO of East Bay Community Energy, Martha Guzman-Aceves, Commissioner at the California Public Utilities Commission, and Michael Wara of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Well, we invite you to call in with questions or comments. Have you been impacted by the recent power outages? And if so, what was your experience? Or are you about to be impacted by the outages that may be happening midweek this week? Do you have questions about how your electricity service might be changing in the future? We want to hear from you. The number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. We're checking those for any questions you might have as well. And we're also at City Visions KALW on Twitter. Well, we have a caller from Santa Rosa. Daniel is joining the conversation. Welcome to City Visions, Daniel.
Thank you. So, yeah, I live in the high fire risk area, Santa Rosa. We were without power and water for 5 days. And although PG&E turned off all our community's power, they kept the power on in the high transmission lines to maximize profit. So we really have two problems. One is that investor-owned utilities always put profit over safety and the public need. And cities up and down the state are expressing the desire to take over the grid. I think it's time that cities and state government do so. But the other problem, even after we make PG&E a publicly owned utility, we're still going to have these high power transmission lines in very remote, high risk areas that are very hard to maintain and get to. And I think part of the solution is making electricity where we use it and not trying to send it over long distances. It's more efficient, it's more carbon neutral. I really think the way of the future is to have local distributed generation systems, solar, wind, geothermal, whatever makes sense in each locale. If Paradise was making its own power instead of bringing it over the mountains, that town might still be there. So I hope your guests will talk about that solution. We can't underground. We can't keep maintaining these wires in remote mountainous areas, we really need to start decentralizing our power grid.
All right. Well, Daniel, thank you for bringing up this as a solution. I've definitely heard others mention it as well. And by the way, I hope all is well up for you in Santa Rosa. You certainly know about the wildfire risks being from up there. But thank you for the questions. And let me direct that first to Michael Wara. Michael, let me give you a chance to respond to Daniel. Do you think more distributed generation, more of that sort of small-scale solar and wind is going to be a critical part of the solution going forward here?
Well, I do think that distributed generation, especially distributed backup power, whether it is storage or some other kind of resource, is a potentially important part of the solution, especially in high-risk areas. That can't work everywhere, and the idea that distributed generation is going to replace, to some degree, our reliance on the grid raises important equity questions about like who can afford it and who has access to it, that I think we need to be resolved if that's a solution that we're going to rely on. But the other piece of this that I think wasn't mentioned by the caller but's really important is thinking about how to provide backup power to businesses in the small communities that are especially impacted by these shutoffs. We're already seeing businesses shut down in some places in the Gold Country because they just can't afford to lose inventory and lose days open during these shutoffs. And I think providing sources of clean, secure backup power through microgrids to the local business district is going to be another really important priority in terms of ensuring the health of communities that are impacted by this risk.
And we have some technologies to do that now with much less expensive solar and batteries. It's just a few of them. Martha, let me ask you, what is the Public Utilities Commission doing about distributed generation, like what Daniel mentioned on the call? Do you think this is an important response? And what are some of the plans in place, if so?
Absolutely. You know, I think that when we talk about, when you introduce this whole segment on whether or not this is the new normal, and we're obviously absolutely committed that it's not. And one of the immediate ways both to deal with the shutoffs in the meantime and in the long term is distributed generation. But one of the things Michael just mentioned on equity is a really critical element of that, because unfortunately historically in the last decade or two decades of our investments in distributed generation, they really have not been equitable. We haven't been looking at a lens of equity. We've been looking at, or resiliency, we've been looking at it just in terms of market development and getting the technology developed. So we are at a point where we can be more intentional about where we put these, be they common investments or individual investments, that they really be focused on where they're going to be most beneficial to the most amount of people. And utilities will have a role in that, and so will different enterprises.
And Nick, at East Bay Community Energy, I know you've started to think about distributed generation technologies. Is EBCE doing anything now, specifically in response to the wildfires, to try to boost distributed generation? What's your take on it?
Yeah, absolutely. East Bay Community Energy, I think many CCAs view ourselves as the enablers of our customers being able to adopt clean energy technology and trying to figure out innovative solutions to be able to deliver the most value to the consumer and to the grid. And so with that in mind, we at East Bay Community Energy initiated a program this past summer where we bought the equivalent of around 200 residential battery systems that will be deployed only at low income multifamily and single family residential properties. They're going to be paired with solar. They're going to allow us to have some control over the battery, to use those batteries during times when the sun isn't shining and we would otherwise be buying natural gas, but they're also going to deliver resiliency to the consumer. That experience was something that we found was so attractive, and in light of the public safety power shutoff challenge that we're facing, we actually have sought to scale that program up from 200 to 4,000 residents. We're partnering with other community choice agencies around the Bay Area, San Mateo County, Santa Clara County, and Alameda County, to go and deploy these systems. And I think it's a unique role that local government can play. We're not We're not worried about some of the, say, revenue impacts or profit impacts that distributed generation might have for a utility. And so we're really focused on what is the clean and most economic solution. I'll also say, to the equity point, we're committed to deploying these resources to serve all our customers. And with that in mind, we actually have a minimum of 20% of the deployments of these solar and storage units that are going to go to low-income residents across Alameda County.
All right. So it sounds like you've got a response that takes into account both equity and resilience and also clean energy technologies as well. Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and streaming live on the web at KALW.org. I'm Ethan Elkind, and tonight we're discussing blackouts and the future of electricity in the Bay Area. We're joined by guests Nick Chassett, who's the CEO of East Bay Community Energy over in Alameda County, Martha Guzman-Aceves, Commissioner at the California Public Utilities Commission, which regulates PG&E, and Michael Wara of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number to dial to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Or post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or our Facebook page. You can also tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Nathan dialing in from Sacramento. Welcome to City Visions, Nathan.
Hello. I know you're all talking about energy. I'm actually somewhat of a nuclear proponent for energy, and I know that's a little taboo these days. I know it's big in the NIMBY crowd kind of as well, but I know it's, you know, a really good carbon, like somewhat carbon-free source of energy, and it's really good at providing a baseload and could be very good, just kind of complementary with renewables and whatnot. So big fan of local, like, municipal energy providers. I'm from Sac, so we got SMUD. It's great to hear about the Oakland locality as well. So just, I don't know, thoughts on nuclear energy, I guess.
All right. Well, no, I appreciate the call, Nathan. So nuclear as a response to what's going on with PG&E. And Michael Wara, let me throw this one to you first.
Unfortunately, you know, nuclear energy is exactly the kind of energy that's going to have to be delivered from far away over wires. And so there's real risk, pardon me, in operating wires, and nuclear energy, clean or not, can't really avoid that risk. And so the one thing I would say is that the nuclear industry has developed a set of practices that really drive safety and high reliability in the power plants. And those practices, that way of maintaining and operating a system as complicated as a nuclear power plant, are a place I think that utilities in California really need to be drawing from to develop better safety practices in their broader system of poles and wires.
And Martha Guzman-Aceves, do you, is nuclear any part of the CPUC's response here, CPUC's response to wildfire or just in general?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly agree with the safety protocols that have been developed in the industry, but no, unfortunately, one, they're really not cost-effective, and much because the amount of investment that's required to make sure it's safe to use makes it not cost-effective. And as you know, we are in the middle of, close to the end of retiring Diablo Canyon, which a major system power, as Michael mentioned, is not a local source. It's a major source for the entire state, really. In Sacramento, Nathan, you may know, I think you said you were from Sacramento also decades ago, phased out the plants that were here, and you know, it all for safety reasons. So I think, you know, replacing it's certainly clean on the GHG side, but it's simply not worth it from a safety perspective.
And Nick, I assume East Bay Community Energy is not contemplating nuclear as a zero carbon resource. Is that right?
We're certainly not looking at nuclear as part of the PSPS challenge. You know, I think the major role that nuclear plays in California is for the next 3 or 4 years while you have Diablo Canyon still operating. And once that goes offline, you know, we won't have any nuclear in state.
And certainly, as people mentioned, panelists here have mentioned, it's expensive to get new ones sited. So thank you, Nathan, for that question. Well, Martha, let me ask you, just to kind of back up here a bit, what is on the list of things that the Public Utilities Commission is doing or wants to do to try to address this problem going forward? What are the reforms? What are the steps that need to be taken short and long term here?
Well, right now we have a couple of things. One is on the immediate and trying to really update our shutoff rules. And we've also, as you probably know, have an investigation on PG&E and the other utilities focused on all that went wrong and what might potentially be needed as a penalty there. But we are equally focused on trying to do more of this dialogue, and both, you know, this is something new to us in terms of getting out to communities and really listening and hearing about both the short and the long-term needs and where the focuses should be. We really need greater participation in our process. It's our process is better informed when we have more local participation. I do think this is an added value of the CCAs being representatives of local government, that they're providing, you know, really basic examples to us, like sharing of where the vulnerable customers are, really basic things like that. So I think, and then moving forward, we're looking at things like you were mentioned earlier, distributed generation being one of them, but also, you know, what is a different model for this utility? How is it going to inherently change and not act as something that's always going to have this privilege of having these customers for themselves? And we have had an ongoing proceeding from the time of post-San Bruno asking this very question. And it's certainly not an easy question. We have a lot of proposals. I know Daniel from San Rosa mentioned that many folks have come to us with a public option and many hybrids thereof. So we're in the middle of that question. It's of paramount importance that we get somewhere within the next 6 months as it relates to the time frame for PG&E and the bankruptcy deadline set by the legislature and the governor. So it's the next kind of time frame for some of the reforms, but it's going to be continuous. We're not going to stop there, because we need to continue to improve this business structure and not have this be the new normal. And so some of it will take these types of infrastructures that we're talking about, hard infrastructure, but some of it is also going to take governance reform within the utility.
And you mentioned the timing here a little bit, but I just wanted to get a little more clarity on when these decisions are going to be made. So bankruptcy is over, hopefully, or depending on your perspective, at the end of June or so. And then at that point, if there are reforms that the Public Utilities Commission wants to put in place, you know, whether it's transitioning to a publicly owned utility, I mean, when would those decisions be made? Is that following the bankruptcy? Do we have to wait till mid-year next year before there's a course of action, or could it be sooner that you might start to recommend or follow through on restructuring PG&E in some way?
Well, that is still an open question. I think, you know, the governor has shown a lot of leadership here in saying that if PG&E and all of the parties involved in bankruptcy don't start to come up with solutions quickly, and not just quickly, but one that works for California, that he's prepared to put forward a proposal himself, which is really the leadership that we need right now to really push the utility in particular to not just think of its own shareholders and equity holders. So regardless of, you know, reforms that occur within bankruptcy, there are still going to be continued things to continue to look at. And some of it is related to the things that we're talking about today in terms of, you know, this round of improvement on PSPS is not going to be the end. We're going to have to continue to look at that. How we're working with local governments, we're going to have to continue to look at that. So vulnerable customers, all of this is not going to be solved by June, although we're very committed to making sure what's happening now and this next, as you mentioned, this week, later this week, and what's happened in the last month does not look the same in the next fall. I'm sorry to not answer your question directly. I just don't think it's going to be most likely some major components in bankruptcy, and we're going to continue even post-bankruptcy. I certainly don't see us, you know, stopping to look at how to make this company better in June. We're not going to end it all there.
All right, so this is going to be a potentially a long process, but maybe some short-term actions might be taken. We'll see, particularly as bankruptcy winds down, hopefully in June. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and also streaming live on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're discussing blackouts and the future of electricity in the Bay Area. We're joined by guests Nick Chassett, CEO of East Bay Community Energy, Martha Guzman-Aceves, Commissioner at the California Public Utilities Commission, and Michael Wara, Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. We want to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation, ask your questions of the panelists, is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email questions to cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at cityvisionskalw on Twitter. Michael Wara, I wanted to ask you what you see likely to happen now with PG&E. I mean, it seems like we're just not going to see PG&E in the same form that we've known it. So what do you think is going to happen, and what should happen going forward?
Well, you know, it depends on what you mean by form. I think that the most likely outcome is that PG&E emerges from bankruptcy as a privately owned company. And I think it's important for folks to understand that most of the public options would probably have to play out over a longer period of time or run the risk of significantly delaying the exit from bankruptcy. And so there are trade-offs there, because currently the management of PG&E is kind of splitting its time between worrying about how to manage the bankruptcy process and all of the issues and decisions that have to be made in that context, and worrying about how to improve the safety and operations of its electricity system, which we obviously want them to be as focused on as possible. So there's real value in kind of getting out of this kind of very kind of shortened time horizon thinking that happens in a bankruptcy process, and getting the utilities management and the whole team that works there and trying to do a good job thinking more long run about how to operate their system safely and reliably in the context of climate change. I think that we are likely to see, and I hope that we see, an enhanced safety culture and more a process of managing risk at PG&E that is much more systematic and quantitative in its approach, and less about, you know, compliance with the rules that the Utility Commission has set for it, and more about managing to provide the highest quality service in a really rigorous way. And I think the utility is starting down that path, but as Commissioner Guzman-Aceves described with respect to San Diego, that walking that road takes time, and it requires training employees and developing process to run a company that way. And I think PG&E is moving in that direction with respect to this risk, but they are not there yet.
Well, I think everybody would agree with you that we certainly hope the safety culture improves at PG&E. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Ted dialing in from San Francisco. Ted, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, I've got a question for the commissioner, but really for all three panelists, which is we're hearing a lot about the idea of state-level or municipal-level takeover of certain of PG&E and the other utilities' responsibilities and operations. Can they just talk about what the actual benefits of that approach might be, or whether there would be benefits to it?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Ted. It's very timely. And actually, let me first direct that to Nick Chassett, because he's working, you know, with Alameda County through East Bay Community Energy. So I'd be curious to hear from you, Nick, first on this, what the benefits might be of a state or local municipalization-type takeover.
So a few weeks ago, a group of mayors led by Mayor Sam Liccardo of San Jose had sent a letter to California Public Utilities Commissioner President Mary Bell Batcher, expressing interest in the formation of, or the transition rather, to a customer-owned utility. So it would not be this idea of breaking PG&E into lots of small regional utilities, but really the idea of a public option, if you will, for the entire PG&E system. And I think the a big part of the public ownership thesis really does come down to costs. So a public utility has the ability to raise capital at a tax-free rate, which is going to be a lower cost mechanism to raise the money that is needed for dealing with wildfire liability, dealing with all the investments that need to be made to get the system to a place where it is more resilient. It's just going to be lower cost way to raise money. And I think in the end, that's probably, from my perspective, the number one argument why in this bankruptcy proceeding, it's so critical for a public option to be given some really strong consideration. I think the other factor to think about in the future of PG&E is this idea of that PG&E might do too much, right? So they own and manage power plants. They own electric infrastructure and gas infrastructure. Perhaps the future is really focusing on infrastructure safety and reliability and not being so focused on buying and electricity and then selling it back to the consumer, particularly given that you have in Northern California so many community choice agencies who are out there already doing that. There is an opportunity for a transition to local control over the electricity generation and sale and a focus at PG&E on infrastructure.
If you started to kind of balkanize PG&E, though, a little bit the way you're describing, though, Nick, I mean, does that create some serious ratepayer impacts?
So I think the model that, you know, is being focused on in this customer-owned approach is not a breaking PG&E up into some lots of small utilities. It's sort of, that's called the idea of de-averaging. Right now, there's a lot of benefits to particularly those who live in higher cost, more rural areas of cost averaging of lower cost to serve areas like in the Bay Area. And so I think what we're talking about here is not 5-10 independent municipal or public utilities, but it's having one large PG&E spanning the whole footprint, benefiting that from that cost averaging, but also benefiting from that low cost of capital. And it's really the CCA, it's the generation, which is not the infrastructure, not the liability, where local control makes a lot of sense.
All right. And Martha, I did want to let you weigh in. I'm sure you probably can't comment in too much depth, given that this is a live issue. But what is your take on terms of the potential benefits, trade-offs of state or local takeover?
Well, I'll say that just some of the participants have stated it. But just to elaborate on a couple more of the stated financial benefits is the obvious one, which is there's no profit. And therefore, that revenue could potentially go back into the systems in the form of reinvestment or otherwise. And I would say the other part of that thesis is dealing with kind of the cultural problem, which is this problem of entitlement, and that you really aren't competing for this customer. And so the notion of having an elected body, whether it's a co-op or some sort of more direct public entity, that you'd have that accountability. So those are kind of the two major drivers that we've heard of from the public, that it's a lower cost option and that there is more direct accountability through an elected process.
And what about if you start to see local takeover? I mean, San Francisco has been making noise for a while and believes they have the resources to fully municipalize their chunk of PG&E service territory. What would play out if that were to occur?
You know, I think, like I said, the governor has welcomed all options on the table. And I don't know if this is the case for the selling of San Francisco as a territory, but one concern I've had in the past and continue to have that we talked about earlier is the concern of equity and what happens if you leave denser, theoretically wealthier areas that may or may not. This is part of what has to happen in an analysis to show, but if you leave, it depends on what happens to the rest of us. And we've seen that in other parts of our economy where we've seen it a lot in the water sector, frankly, where some systems are much more underinvested and fragile because they don't have the scale. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think anybody is there's a lot more questions there that need to be answered, but I don't think anybody knows definitively. It may be a good thing, it may not be a good thing.
All right, and Nick, did you just want to respond to that quickly?
Yeah, just one comment. I think when you're thinking about the perspective or magnitude of the benefits of a public option, You just have to look at a bill that was introduced this past August in the California legislature, AB 235, that would have allowed PG&E to raise $20 billion that would have been paid for solely as a reduction in shareholder profit. So that's not even all shareholder profit going away. That's simply a reduction in the shareholder profit, which is now over 10%. So you think about that over 10, 15, 20 years, that's the magnitude of potential benefit that a public option could deliver.
That we could then potentially reinvest. And actually, along those lines, Michael Warr, I wanted to get your take on this, because this is an important issue. This is sort of the short-term need here, is about hardening the grid. And, you know, with opening of the show, you talked about some of the aging infrastructure. What's being done right now? What should be done to try to improve the fire safety of our existing infrastructure? And if you could just help us describe the basics, how many miles are we talking about here?
Ethan, I just want to point one thing out about the public option before we move on. I think it's really important for everyone to understand the key issue that I think needs to be addressed on these proposals is how the risks of fire are managed. The reason that PG&E is bankrupt is that investors no longer have confidence that the company can make money given the risk of fire in the state. And if you make it a public utility, that means that that risk is transferred to the public balance sheet, so that if and when there were a fire, you could have a municipal bankruptcy on your hands that might involve the utility only if it were a co-op, or it might involve local governments. And that's a really important risk to think about, how we would manage something like what we've seen over the last couple of years, $20, $30 billion in fire victim liability, if it were a public liability as opposed to a private one.
Although,
as far as I know, the plans have not really spelled this out.
Well, just to jump in on this point, Michael, I do want to hear about hardening the grid. But you know, presumably, if the state took it over, wouldn't they be more interested in changing the liability arrangement? I mean, right now, PG&E is 100% liable, even if it's the fault of local governments or for permitting development in these high fire risk zones, or the fault of individual homeowners that didn't maintain their property. So, wouldn't there be more incentive for the liability structure to change at that point?
Well, perhaps, and certainly the local governments and the local municipally owned utilities, I shouldn't say local governments, but the local municipally owned utilities that do exist in California have been the strongest advocates for changing the liability regime and weakening the responsibility of the utility for when these fires do occur. So yes, it might change, but it wouldn't eliminate the risk. And that's the really important thing to think about is, are we more comfortable managing that risk as, potentially a budget liability for local government or for the state government, or do we want to keep it at arm's length in the private sector? Mm-hmm. And what makes the most sense for the state? What's going to create the best incentives to manage the risk and reduce it to the extent it's possible? Mm-hmm. To pivot to your question about grid hardening, there's a significant number of steps that utilities can take. One that's often mentioned is using so-called tree wire. So most wire that's hung on poles in distribution systems is uninsulated. It's bare metal. So when it gets knocked down by a branch, or if a branch lands on it, a fire can ignite immediately. You can hang wire from poles that has insulation wrapped around it, so that it's much less likely that if it falls on the ground, it's going to start a fire. It doesn't eliminate the risk, but it makes it less likely. Another thing you can do is essentially break the grid up into smaller pieces. That's called sectionalizing. And the idea with that is that it will allow the utilities to turn, even if they have to use power shutoff in the future, they can turn off smaller pieces of the grid and impact fewer customers, because the grid will be broken up into smaller pieces, and they can turn off just the risky part and not areas that are adjacent to the high-risk locations. Another thing that the utilities are doing is just deploying a lot of weather stations on their poles so that they can understand better what the conditions actually are, and perhaps relocate some lines out of the most risky areas. San Diego has learned a lot about weather conditions in their system that they just really didn't understand from the National Weather Service data, which is obviously, less fine-grained than what is the wind speed at the top of this 40-foot pole in this distribution circuit. And so PG&E and Edison have deployed a lot of those weather stations with commission approval over the last year, and they're just now, they're collecting their first season of fire weather data, And I would assume that they're going to spend the rainy season analyzing that data and figuring out, you know, changes they can make to their grid architecture to increase safety. There are also kind of higher tech, you know, emerging technologies. There are switches that can sense a fault in the system, like when a tree branch lands on a wire, before the wire actually hits the ground, and turn the system off so that you have a cold wire when it hits the ground. And those are things where I think are in the more of the pilot phase, but are, you know, where deployment is being maybe accelerated because we're so desperate to find solutions to this problem and to reduce the impacts of power shutoffs in Northern California.
So that's a really helpful overview of all the different options on the table. And we just have a few minutes left, so that tees up a question for Martha, which is, how long is it going to take to implement some of the solutions that Michael just described?
Well, some of what Michael described is in implementation mode now. And I think what we're looking at, based on all the support and leadership we've gotten from both the legislature and the governor, is how we even expedite much of that quicker. And certainly, you know, some of it is geared towards the long-term fixes to all of this. And as we talked about, some of it will not be so centralized. Some of it will be decentralized. So I think we're going to move a lot quicker than what was able to happen in San Diego. They were doing that largely on their own leadership. I think this obviously has a much larger territory, but we have so much more engagement. We have obviously the partnerships of the CCAs and all the local governments. So I don't have a fixed timeline, but I know that we're working on 60-90 days on a rolling basis. So it's certainly going to be improved upon every year after year. And I did want to make one additional point on the infrastructure need, because it actually relates to the wastewater story you were talking about earlier, and it relates to a very important hearing we're having on Wednesday, and that's our telecommunications infrastructure and the ability of that infrastructure to be just as resilient as our electricity infrastructure. And it's a very difficult situation because, as you can see, even in a jurisdictional area where we have the ability to direct a utility, we have these challenges.
And certainly, people have had telecommunications outages as well. So that's definitely an important issue for people. I just want to be able to give Nick the last word here before we wrap up, because we're running out of time. But Nick, what do you see as a future here over the next year? I mean, are we going to be back in this situation a year from now with more blackouts?
You know, I think unfortunately, none of the systematic solutions are short-term fixes that are going to fundamentally stop this from happening again. I do think there are some great near-term opportunities to improve communication to lessen the impact. I'm hopeful that the work the commission is pursuing is going to reduce the scope of future public safety power shutoffs. And I'm very excited about the work that community choice agencies like East Bay and others are doing to deploy solar and storage to create some more real, tangible resiliency in our communities.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time, and that's City Visions for this evening. I want to thank our guest, Nick Chassett, CEO of East Bay Community Energy. Thanks for being here. And I want to thank Martha Guzman-Aceves, Commissioner at the California Public Utilities Commission. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you.
And Michael Wara of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment.
Thanks for having me on.
And thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. If you want to delve further in this topic, KALW has a series called California Burning that airs Thursday evenings. You can check for more details on our website. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David La Tulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. Well, City Visions is taking a week off. Next Monday at 7 p.m., KALW will air a documentary from American Public Media called Uprooted, the 1950s Plan to Erase Indian Country. And City Visions will then be back online and live broadcasting on Monday, December 2nd. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.